Welcome to At Work in America, sponsored by Paychex. At Work in America digs in behind the headlines and trends to the stories of real people making a difference in the world of work. And now, here are your hosts, Steve Bowes and Trish Steed.
Hi, welcome back to the At Work in America show. My name's Steve Bowes, and I'm joined by Trish Steed. Trish, how are you today?
I'm fantastic. How are you doing?
I am well. I'm excited. It's, as we record this, it is March Madness about to start again. Sweet 16 games tonight. Sadly, though, Trish, your team and my team both out in the first round. That was
first
awful.
Round. Does that make you still, like, do you watch it still if your team's out? Like, for me, I'm kind of like, I don't really care now. Is that bad?
No, it's not bad. I've been less interested in it myself. I'll probably watch the finals or something, but yeah, it's unfortunate. But I remember 7 years ago, Trish, we went to the Final Four, as a matter of fact, when my school made the Final Four in 2017. So at least there's that memory to cling to. So, hey, we've got a great show today. I'm excited for today's guest.
I am too. This is going to be, I'm going to call this a business self-help show, right? So we both have had the opportunity to read a phenomenal book called Dare to Be Naive, and we're going to talk to the author. I promise you as listeners, this is not just a boring interview. You're going to walk away with some actionable things you can do back in your workplace and in your personal life, probably. So hope everyone tunes in.
Yeah, that's going to be a great conversation. And before we jump to that conversation, Trish, let's thank our friends at Paychex, of course. This episode of At Work in America is sponsored by Paychex, one of the leading providers of HR, payroll, retirement, and insurance solutions for businesses of all sizes. Trish, 2024, it's going to be an incredible year for HR tech. There's AI, there's automation, there's all kinds of new technologies emerging in the HR tech space, but lots of folks are probably out there saying, where do I even start? How do I begin contemplating new HR tech? How do I assess the market? What should I be looking for? Well, we worked together with nine of our friends, HR and HR tech thought leaders and Paychex, to assemble a new guide, a buyer's guide for HR tech for 2024. It has insights to help listeners evaluate, shop for, and actually start using new HR technology and new software that can save their organizations time, resources, and more. So I think folks should check this out. This is one of the best projects we've worked on in a long time. I'm ecstatic of how well it came out. You can get your copy of the Buyer's Guide to HR Tech today free at paychex.com/AWIA. That's paychex.com/AWIA to start your journey today. So check that out. We'll put a link in the show notes as well. And thanks to our friends at Paychex. We are excited to welcome our guest today. He is Joshua Berry. He's the co-founder and managing director of Econic and the author of Dare to Be Naive. He's a world-class facilitator of change. Joshua has spent the last two decades evolving the what, who, and why of Fortune 500 companies and venture-backed startups. Joshua, welcome to the show. How are you today?
Steve and Trish, I'm doing great. Big fans of the show for many years, and so excited to be with you today.
It's awesome to have you, and maybe we can, Trish, we'll start there. Like, you are once again, you were the impetus behind this show and having Joshua on. Maybe, Trish, I'll have you say a couple words about why we're even doing this show.
Yeah, so I actually have a copy of the book, thanks to Joshua, and it's an excellent book. So number one, that was kind of a point of, yeah, I told it way back there. Well, we're not going to be able to see it.
I got it.
It's disappearing. Yep. So anyway, you have the book. But no, we were actually at an event last fall. There you go. He's got the book. We were at an event last fall. We got to talking. I mean, we've known each other a very long time. I can't even imagine, like, a decade or something. So we go way back. And anyway, we were talking, though, a lot about just work and how people are coming and showing up to work, especially now that, you know, sort of the pandemic sort of period is over, but people, some are in the office, not in the office. And really, the book sparked my interest because when you think about how we show up, whether it's to a workplace that you're going to, whether you're in your home and trying to work with colleagues that way, it's really important to have self-reflection and to think about that. And so for me, that was the most interesting point, was how are we going to really reflect on our own approach to how we show up for people, how we show up for our companies, how we show up for our customers. And I think this book is just chock full of exercises and things we can dive into. So that's really what led to it. Other than that, Josh was just a great guy. And now that I'm in Lincoln a good chunk of the time, fellow Lincolner, is that the way?
Yeah, Lincolnite.
Lincolnite. I'm a fellow Lincolnite, even though I'm not there today. But yeah, so just wanted to have him on the show and really share this message, because I think it's a little bit different twist on what we normally hear. And the last thing, Steve, I would say is that, as you know, we recently had Pat Waters, the chief people officer from UKG, on the show, and she was talking a lot about being vulnerable at work. And so I think these two episodes really tie nicely together, because there is great value when you start being yourself truly and feeling comfortable and safe to do that. So I think that was more of a high level conversation. And this one I know is going to get us into sort of the nuts and bolts of how do we actually make that happen.
Great, great. So welcome, Joshua, as I said. And we had the briefest of bios I just shared a moment ago. Maybe we'll start with that. Like, tell us a little bit more about you, you know, beyond that three sentence bio.
Sure,
and then let's
sure.
get into, hey, It's a leap from, you know, your professional work, your career, and your consultancy to, boom, I'm going to sit down and write this book, right? Because that's a big step. I'd love to learn a little bit about, you know, the A to B there.
Sure, absolutely. So brief background, I went to school for international business and Spanish. Spent my first 10 years in an HR consultancy, specifically focused on talent assessment and development. And that brought me around the world, working with companies like the Ritz-Carlton Hotel Company or Mercedes-Benz or Cheesecake Factory restaurants, where, of course, I gained a bunch of weight helping those people. And then that led to going into my first startup. We put our house up for sale. We were pregnant with our fourth kid, and I jumped all into a startup that was focused on people's motivation and why they do the things that they do. That did not go as hoped. And so a lot of lessons learned there parlayed into helping other venture-backed startups. And then that started to come together in 2015 when we co-founded Econic, which is the current business that we do today, which is more focused on corporate transformation, specifically in spaces of innovation and leadership change. And book writing wise, yeah, it was about 7 years into our journey with Econic, and just professional growth for myself in terms of starting to understand some of the ways that I could see work evolving for good, and maybe what some of those barriers were for anybody from leaders to managers, figuring out how to shift the how and why of work. Mm-hmm. But then also some personal growth for myself, you know, some of that self-doubt about my desire to put thoughts out into the world. And so the book became not only a professional, but also a personal growth moment for me.
Thanks for sharing that, Joshua. I wonder, it seems like, you know, we don't have authors on regularly, but we had one on a few months ago, and it was a very similar journey. And it's sort of what you might perceive or be going through is maybe a failure, right? With that startup, you sort of parlay that into some really interesting lessons that you take away from that makes your next venture stronger. Do you think that also played into this book at all? Or, because I hear a lot of people say, like, I'm too afraid, like, I'm not an expert on anything, I can't write.
Yeah, exactly. And I was not the person who was doing a daily blog or a daily email newsletter or anything and moved into it. I really had to be pushed into it. And there were a number of instances, even leading up to it, a couple years prior, in fact, to starting the book, I was planning on co-authoring a book with someone who was already a New York Times bestseller, and eventually it broke down. She's like, the way you want to write a book with me is how I would feel about writing a book with Brené Brown. And it's like a dagger into the heart. And and it fed that voice in my head again of like, see, you're not supposed to go write a book. And so, you know, it's a constant battle that I think we have. And that's at the core, I think, of a growth mindset, right? It's never 100% that you're always on and at your best self. It's so easy to slip into being defensive and protecting yourself and your ego. But those moments when we do get people around us or within ourselves, and we're able to push through some of those things are some of the best moments of life. And yeah, that has led to a number of the things in the book.
Joshua, the book is called Dare to Be Naive, right? Which I love the title, but the first thing you have to do in the book really is kind of break down that word, naive, because it does have that connotation of, just being kind of uninformed, easily taken advantage of, just not in a business context. Being called naive is often, that's the kiss of death. So let's start there with both the title and sort of understanding a little bit more about what you mean when you say naive.
Yeah, it was what came out of the research when I was interviewing great leaders who had chosen to figure out ways to make their business successful, but also were using their businesses for good. And what I mean there is just continuing to think about the other stakeholders involved and the impact that they're having beyond just the bottom line. And what struck me was it wasn't just they finally learned the return on investment and it was a good business decision to use their businesses for good. There was something else. And the pattern that I saw is they frequently said, "This might sound naive, but," and then they led into a great idea or a great philosophy or a belief. And I even saw that those successful leaders, great egos and everything, were using this, like, "This might sound naive," as a shield. And that's what really dropped me into this hole of, well, what does naive even mean? And to your point, the current modern definition of naivete is to be unsophisticated and to be uninformed and aloof, and therefore it is the kiss of death. And yet, if you actually dig into the etymology, the meaning of that word, naive wasn't a negative thing even a few hundred years ago. Like, it really just meant genuine and authentic and that which was in you from the start. And I don't think it's a coincidence then that, the Merriam-Webster word of the year last year was authentic. And our great ancestors would have used the word naive also mean, hey, you're doing something that's authentic and that's you. And so that is the case that I use it in. And we can dig into that, it's very much a balance of what I talk about in terms of it isn't just throw all of your reason out the window and go chase that.
Do you think, Joshua, that sort of embracing that naivete, if you will, especially in the way that you're framing that, if you're a business leader, I almost get the sense that that is maybe the secret sauce to what builds better connection with your colleagues, with your employees, your teams? I mean, have you found that there is a link there? Because sometimes I feel like a leader will put on a front, like a mask. At work, they're very stoic, maybe they want to always appear knowledgeable. I feel like if you're bringing your naivete to work, you are showing you're vulnerable, right?
Absolutely.
Does it make you more relatable? Is that why you're finding that these leaders are having great success?
100%. They are being more themselves, and people like to work with other people that are also imperfect, I guess, is the best way that I can say it. Like, we are all imperfect, and being able to show some of that and that vulnerability is important. It also, there's a confident humility that I saw in some of these people as well. It wasn't that they were extremely passive or that everything, they still desired to achieve things and work through things, and they were looking for a genuine ROI in their business. But they also realized that there was something else that mattered more beyond just what they were bringing. And they didn't always know how to get to that or what it could be. And so it ended up being what I call a chosen naivety, which was a combination of this great rational thinking mind with this curiosity and this wonder and this listening to maybe other voices that you can't always rationally explain the reason why it is, but it just feels right to you.
Josh, the book is interesting because it has a multitude of, I don't even want to use the word case studies because they're more stories, right? They're more,
Anecdotes, yeah.
business stories about different organizations around the world who have adopted different or unusual or non-traditional business practices and achieved really some really exciting and positive outcomes. And kind of, I guess my sort of when I stopped. When I got to the end of the book, I was thinking, well, this is kind of what I'm taking this way is, hey, business doesn't have to be done like the typical way, like it, you have Milton Friedman quote in the book, right? The Milton Friedman way, which is essentially the only reason a business exists is to maximize the value to shareholders, very specifically, right? And, you know, we're presenting lots of different alternatives to that approach. I'd love for you to maybe share one or two of those, either specific stories that you talk about in the book or more general, like, what does this mean, right? How do we translate the idea of, hey, it's better to be approached with naivete, with authenticity, with genuineness, and how that sort of changes our traditional approaches to business?
Yeah. So as you mentioned, the first half of the book sets it up and what do we mean, and helps people get over the hump of, do I actually want to be naive, and how really beliefs power our practices, right? And then the whole second half of the book is these chapters that get into, as you said, some more non-traditional business practices, things like letting people have side hustles, or being more relaxed with your intellectual property, or lessons that can be learned from pay what you want businesses. And the first thing that I want to call out before anybody's like, I'm not going to show my boss this book, is that it is not a how-to book and saying those are the right way to do things. And I think that's very important, because I think the world has enough books that say this is how to do it, and here's the 10 steps you need to follow. And I don't think we need another book that tells us what to adopt. This book was created to help people understand how to adapt and to start to think for themselves. In fact, I kind of push off this idea of being a thought leader, because again, this book is about helping people lead their own thoughts at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. And so one of those examples is Manisha Singh. She was a manager, not the head of HR, but a manager in a large global 500 company. And they're having to remake their talent marketplace. They were specifically, though, having to decide what some of the rules and the algorithms would be within this open talent marketplace. And anybody who's been involved in any sort of large process design, you have to think about all the stakeholders that are in there. And one of the key pivot points that they had to come to was, whose priorities are we going to value more, the managers or the employees? For instance, you know, Trish, if there was a great match for a job outside of a department, should your manager have the say if you get to apply to that, or should you get the opportunity? And of course, that's an interesting paradox to think through, because that has to be designed into the system. And that pushed them as they really reflected upon that practice. They had to dig in and think about, well, what are the beliefs that power our practices of one over the other? And as you can read in the story, that they ended up landing on a spot where they said, you know, we're going to prioritize employee needs even over the manager's needs. And we think that that's the right thing to do. Now, back to the first point that I made, the book doesn't say, and that's now what you need to go do. The book introduces a framework that says, hey, there's a practice. Hopefully what that did is that like poked you in the head or poked you in the heart a little bit to say, did you agree with that? Did you disagree with that? What do you think there? And then most importantly, what do you believe about something like this? Right? The one that I get a lot of pushback on, the IP chapter. Because in essence, it talks a little bit about some organizations that are being more free and open with their intellectual property. And again, it doesn't advocate for go open up the secret recipes. But what it does say is, think about what you believe here. And now, where did you create that belief? And is it really true? What do you gain and what do you lose by holding that belief? And so it creates spaces of reflection and intentionality. Because we have so much of the change that you two report on all the time is increasing and rapidly increasing. And what I think we need to do is actually take a little bit of time and go a little bit slower, be more intentional about the decisions that we're making so that we can go faster in some of those ways. And that's what those frameworks and tools are meant to be.
I love that you shared those examples, because the book is just completely full of examples like that. And it really is, to me, as I was reading it, it's designed for me to think about. And I tried to pick out the ones, where do I see myself currently, or where do I see I want to be? Because those might be two different things. From that standpoint, I sort of thought about having that growth mindset, being intentional. You know, you mentioned, I wrote down that confident humility, right? So I think for me, if a leader is picking up this book, aren't they in fact then able to say, yeah, I recognize this might be my approach, where I'm at, But boy, this one sounds really exciting, really intriguing. Are you
Yeah.
hearing stories of people that say like, that one got me, and now I'm
Absolutely.
running this direction?
Yeah, absolutely. So they definitely are sparking and thinking about things. I will say the side, so there's a chapter on side hustles and permitting research and several anecdotes of companies who have encouraged side hustles among their employees. That one has obviously caused a lot of people, especially in today's gig economy, to say, what do we believe here? What are our practices going to be? And some of the executive teams that we work with, whether they're talking about allowing side hustles or what their balance of return to work policy might look like, what's forcing and creating is they're not arguing up at this level of 3 days in the office, 2 days in the office, or no side hustles or yes side hustles. They're actually starting to say, well, what do you believe? Well, what do you believe? Where did that come from? And they're starting to have richer conversations because there's obviously going to be different points of views. And most of the arguments and debate people are having are because that there is some other fundamental assumption about human nature, human behavior underneath of it all. And those are the things that teams can further get into alignment, or at least not even alignment, at least understanding perspective for the diversity of what those beliefs might be, and then be able to figure out how those things are reflected into the evolving practices at work.
That makes sense.
Joshua, you mentioned this idea of the assumptions we make or that we have about human nature and
Yeah.
how we believe people are going to act, especially
Yeah.
people in an organization where one of the stories that really stood out to me in the book, Joshua, was the factory in France,
Yeah.
was right where the new CEO is named, and it was a male. I don't remember his name off the top of my head, but he arrives to find some curious rules and business policies that had been implemented. Mostly, I'm not going to give away the whole story in the book, and you can
Yeah.
read the book and get the story, but mostly around very much control, command and control kinds of things, very strict rules around supplies and clocking in and clocking out. And the things many of us have lived in our work lives as well, right? It's not an uncommon thing. And the story goes on to expand upon how he interprets some of those rules and what he does to change them. And you talk about it yourself, Joshua, as being someone who defaults to trust, right? I'm going to trust people first unless I find some reason not to. Maybe let's talk about that a little bit, because I think we've come up certainly in businesses where the old ways of doing things and not defaulting to trust of people, especially in the workplace, has been the default or the go-to for too many organizations.
So Jean-François, that CEO at that factory, he made all these shifts and changes. But the reason why he made some of those changes is he observed that that a lot of the prior ideas of the org chart or systems were built upon the belief that mankind is bad or they're going to cheat. And what he really said is going back to Douglas MacGregor's work from the 60s and Maslow's work and whatnot, is saying that what would happen if we created an organization where the base assumption was mankind was good? And his belief was, and people well before him, was that people tend to act as they are considered. And so that's where there's a concept in the book that I talk about ripples of impact, and specifically thinking about either vicious or virtuous cycles that we create within our practices in work and especially in HR. When we create policies that potentially assume people are going to cheat and we're trying to prevent them from that, often subconsciously, people will tend to act as they are considered. And similarly, that's where the trust comes in terms of the extension of when trust is extended, oftentimes trust comes back to it. And there are a number of stories in the book that talk about that, but I'll just speak from our own business. I have found many times when I think about the level of transparency we have in our financials to our employees, or the trust that's given for people to have a side hustle, or any of these other instances that a lot of my peers do look at me and say, like, oh, that's naive. Like, you as the owner, you get to take and reap a bunch more rewards. And when I challenge and say, like, actually, we have enough. And so we're pursuing more equitable pay ratios. And here's the transparency that we're doing. Well, that's really naive. That's not how things could be done. I take it upon at least myself that if I want to see a different world for my kids, I want to start to act in small ways that create virtuous cycles where that can be more of what's happening. And that was what was represented in that story with Jean-Francois. Not only did they start to drastically improve the results within that factory, significantly grow market share, significantly improve the productivity, but also the well-being of the employees was improved. People were showing up and staying later. Like all of the other things that we're saying we're trying to chase from an employee engagement or performance standpoint started to take care of themselves because people were acting as they were considered.
Yeah.
I'm so glad, Steve, that you brought up the trust component, and Joshua, that you actually touched on ripples of interest. Like that was going to be my next question. So I'm so grateful that that popped up. But I would also love you to talk a little bit about not just the role that trust plays, right, in that relationship within an organization. What about love, right? This is one that, at least in my career, I was sort of trained in professional services. There is no love or caring or compassion, right, in an organization. We are there to purely do what's right for the shareholders. So with that in mind, with many of the people listening might have been raised that way, but want to incorporate a more loving work environment. Where does that fit?
It that hits very close to home for me. And so the way that I have reconciled that and brought it into the workplace and with the clients that we work on is to first start with what I think is a pretty good working definition of love. This comes from Eric Fromm, the book, The Art of Loving, written 50 some years ago. And it's the active concern for the care and development of the other. And when you start to think about that active concern for the care and development of one another, if I remove the word love from that, I don't know how many managers or leaders aren't going to say, nope, we don't want to have active concern for the care and development of our people or our customers or our suppliers or our vendors or anything else. And so when we turn it into an actionable thing and we say, how do we care about their growth and development? Yes, then absolutely. And that can maybe like going to an extreme example, we have layoffs, right? Not saying we're having layoffs, but let's say we have, some company had layoffs. I do believe at the heart of hearts of people, they actively are concerned about the care and growth of people. They're thinking about the sustainability of the business. They're thinking about the people on the other side. They're thinking about those things. And when you can bring that sort of care and concern into it, it may not always come with the results that are desired or that the employee wants or the employer wants in those cases, but there still can be that feeling of there. I mean, there have been people on my team that we've had to fire. And because of the way we've approached it leading up to it, during it, and afterwards, I would say it was done in a loving way. Mm. And I think that, so it doesn't have to be a performance or love sort of thing, I guess is what I'm also saying here. Because if I truly, I'm thinking of an individual from 2 years ago, if I truly cared about their growth and their development, their care, and I knew that this was not the right fit and we were not the right culture for them at that time, why would I continue to hold on to them in that way? And so there's a deeper meaning when I think about what love could be and how that's continued to evolve in the workplace.
Thank you for those examples. I think that as someone who has been on the delivery side of many layoffs in my career, it's a gut-wrenching experience if you are the manager making that decision, that choice. It is certainly the gut-wrenching experience if you are the one delivering that message personally to, you know, I've done as many as 50 in a day individually. So it's like, to me, you can't get through that without demonstrating love and care and compassion, because these are people. These aren't, it's not a number, it's not a spreadsheet, right? But then on the flip side, I understand what you're saying, because when I was laid off many years ago, after being somewhere for 10 years, you know, I was either given a choice I didn't like of moving, or that was it, right? Mm-hmm. It was handled in such a loving way that I am still in contact with all of my bosses there. I think so highly of them because they treated me with such care and respect. Yeah. So I think that your description, I love that idea of having a definition, and you might not even need to say what the word is. That's probably true with a lot of ways that we approach work, right? Focus on what is the goal of the treatment and of the feeling versus, you know, we think like, oh gosh, we can't have love at work. Well,
yeah. Really, and just to maybe apply that framework that I gave before to, because that's the core of what I hope people take away from here, regardless of if you can change new programs or bring in or say love or not or work or anything at all, is you have the agency to even say, take what we just said, love should be in the workplace, period. Where did you learn that? Is it true? And then what do you gain and what do you lose by holding that belief? Love should be in the workplace. Like, because even I know there are things I lose because I choose to bring that into the workplace. If we could all just help people wake up a little bit more and be a little bit more conscious about whatever beliefs they're buying from the three of us today or anybody else, and just start to think for themselves and reclaim some of that agency, I think people can wake up again more to what the subtitle of the book is, which is waking up to their true self in a noisy world.
Well, I think too, if you're someone who's more stoic and that's how you've been raised throughout your career, in some ways it is more difficult, but in some ways, like in the case of layoffs or even, letting one person go, you think it's preventing you from getting hurt, really. It's a little bit of self-preservation, I find. You know, if I'm an HR and I'm working with a leader, they're trying to protect their own feelings, really. They're not going to say that, but if you can get them past that and say, no, let's feel this. Let's feel these feelings with this person. We're changing their life. How do we then help them on that next step? I will say this, across the board, every company I've worked for where we've had layoffs or you let someone go, if you handle them that way, very respectfully, very lovingly, they always wind up in a better place. Always. And then they will call you, email you, give you a thank you card. Like, they circle back and they say, gosh, thank you for that. Now I'm much better off. Now I see it. So you mentioning an employee, if you have to let them go, gosh, it could be better for them. It could be better for you as a business, right?
Absolutely.
Joshua, the last thing I think I wanted to ask, and I had two things. I'm only going to pick one though, in the interest of being respectful to your time as well as, we do a lot of work here with our H3 HR Advisors team and on the podcast, our family, with the newest folks entering the workplace, our Gen Z friends, right? We have a Gen Z podcast. Trish and I are both parents of Gen Z people. I'm not sure, Joshua, how old your kids are, but I'm sure you have thought about this some, at least either at home or at work or both. I'd love for you to maybe talk about that a little bit and how will organizations really be forced to think a little bit more differently about work? Because is it true, really, that you're seeing that Gen Z is coming in and thinking about values and mission and how a company makes money versus just, if they make money? That I'd love to you to comment on that some.
Absolutely. I just actually volunteered and gave a workshop at the university here in Lincoln this morning on the evolution of the workplace in the last 20 years to our Lifelong Learners Initiative group here. And one of the key things, that there was a focus on was how is that shifting and what that compact is, right, between employer and employee. And some of those big value shifts that we see in millennial and Gen Z absolutely are around why am I doing this? What is the purpose of this? The passion for it. One of the surveys I quote in the book, I'm not going to recall the source off the top of my head, but it was that 75% of millennials would take a pay cut to go to a more responsible company in the definition of in the book. But I think we're seeing more and more that idea that the why you're doing something matters more than ever. The why in my job, the why in the business, the who we're serving, what our stances are and where they're going, and that those things might shift. And so even the tools that I provide and we started to talk about here help people get to more of the why we're doing some of those sorts of things. And so, I think we need to pay more attention to it.
You
know,
absolutely.
I'm glad that you mentioned Gen Z, Steve, because to me earlier, something I wrote down sparked my thought of this is actually a book, Joshua, I think needs to be in the hand of educators, especially at the high school level, right? Because I think many of us took on maybe some less desirable traits or skills in the workplace, right? And we've brought those forward over the years. So we're having, maybe people in their 50s are having to unlearn, people in their 40s are having to unlearn a little bit some of these barriers we've put on ourselves. I wonder, are you getting any interest, or is that a thought to get this in the hands of educators, or is there a different version that could come out for kind of preparing the workforce, future workforce?
So I would love to see if there's a broader interest in it. There's been some interest from some business ethics classes that we've talked to, just because obviously of how the book is set up. And it was included in the our publisher put it in the catalog that went out to all the universities to potentially be chosen for core curriculum or for first year.
Yes.
And then in a couple of months, I have a webinar that we're doing for, it's like the Association of Alumni Book Clubs or something. And so I'm hoping that there's going to continue to be some inroads into some of that, because you know, part of my life's mission is to evolve work and school to unleash more human potential on the world's biggest problems. And so much of that is because I see so often when we're working with senior leaders, like so much of this has, to your point, been baked in a way that I want to honor and respect. And I want to find ways that we can continue to help people develop more of those critical thinking capabilities that they're having to hire us for now to be able to start to bring back to the workforce and bring in some of that adaptability and learning like we do in our innovation programs.
I think well, those
your
are
framework
all...
does it. I think the book framework really shows that it's possible. I feel changed, Steve. I'm being serious. Like, I don't know if you feel changed after reading it. I actually do. I'm actually thinking about work differently. I'm thinking about my relationships with people in general differently.
I love just at the end of every chapter where it's like, okay, what is this belief you have? Are you sure it's true? What are you gaining by holding on to this belief, and what might you be losing? I love that approach just to help you reevaluate the things that you're taking to work every day, or maybe even in outside of work as well. So to me, that was so just spot on. So yeah, I love the book, Joshua. I'm not just telling you that because we're sitting here talking to you, but
Thanks,
fantastic stuff. So the book is Dare to Be Naive. I don't know if you can read that because
my
lighting is so bright. And I will tell a quick story real quick. I'll let you go. You can see on the back of my book, there's a...
Oh, it's like burnt.
So my desk was so messy, right? And the book had come a couple of weeks ago and it was on my desk and I was shuffling things around and I had moved it to the side to do something else. And after some period of time, I was in the house by myself at the time too. And I thought, I smell something like... Did I leave the stove on? Is the oven on? Is something happening? And then I got up and looked around, couldn't discover anything. Sat back down, continued to work. Then it's got even stronger, that smell of, boy, something I think is, there's a problem here in the house. Something couldn't discover it. Sat back down a third time. And finally, I realized, oh my gosh, the book is on fire because I set it down. I have one of those... warming coffee mug things. And I set it on there and it was just enough heft in the book, Joshua, to turn the heating element on in the pad. It must have been on there for an hour and a half, and finally I pulled it off of there and it wasn't quite in flames, but it was smoking pretty good. And I ran outside with the book just in case and set it outside for a little bit, and then I brought it back in. It was fine. So it is
indestructible.
It did. So
look at that. It's like a Stanley, but
look at that. I know, isn't that incredible?
Oh my gosh.
So that's my burning book story. But
there you go. So audio listeners, make sure you come check out the video because that's impressive.
I almost burned the house down for your book, Joshua. That's how much I cared. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to put links to your website. It's joshuaberry.com. We will link there. Also your LinkedIn profile if folks want to find you and connect with you. Joshua, this has been so much fun. I love the book. Trish did as well. Thank you for spending some time with us and congratulations on this. It's fantastic.
Thank you. May it continue to light a fire within everybody who...
I love that.
Correctly.
I love that.
And you know what? If you're listening, I know, Joshua, if you would just like maybe hold it up and turn it sideways, this is not a huge, huge book, right? It's a good, easy read. And I read it more that I could even jump around a little bit.
That's exactly it.
And I look at it now, like now that I've kind of gone through it, I can go back just to certain chapters, to certain exercises. So it's going to be one of those, I think, that you actually keep on your desk when you buy it and go back to it when you need it. It's more of
Thank
like
you.
a book that you read and a reference material.
Yeah, so, for sure.
Good
Thank
job.
You.
All right. Good. Great stuff. Thanks again, Joshua. Trish, thank you. Thank you to our friends at Paychex, of course. And remember, all the show archives are at hrhappyhour.net. And you could subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. My name is Steve Bowes. For Trish Steed, for our guest, Joshua Berry, thank you so much for listening. We will see you next time. And bye for now.